Now, in what sense are these actually discrete stages?
Well, the basic levels themselves are fairly discrete, identifiable structures. Their worldviews are very specific, and they differ from each other in important and easily identifiable ways. Each has a different architecture with different cognitions, which support a different self-sense, different moral stances, different self-needs, and so on. But as always, the ladder is not where the real action is. The real action is the climber of the ladder, the self-system, and the fulcrums that are generated with this climb. And the self, as we said, can be all over the place. It can have a peak experience of a higher level, only to fall back into its actual and present self stage. Conversely, a taste of the higher levels can so disrupt the self that it regresses to earlier fulcrums, fulcrums at which there is still some sort of fixation or repression or unfinished business. As egoic translation starts to wind down, these earlier stick points jump out.
So the actual growth of the self in the transpersonal stages isn't linear in any sort of rigid sense.
No, not at all. The fact that the higher realms are ladder-like, which means concentric spheres or nested holarchy, doesn't mean that growth through them is ladder-like. There are all sorts of ups and downs and spirals.
Not to mention altered states or peak experiences.
Oh, yes. The self at virtually any stage of development can have various types of peak experiences or altered states, including peak experiences of the transpersonal realms. For example, a self at the magic, mythic, rational, or existential levels can have a peak experience of the psychic, subtle, causal, or non-dual realms, and in each case you would get a different type of spiritual experience. But as we were also saying, these temporary states still need to be converted into enduring traits if development into these realms is to become permanent. And so even though altered states and non-ordinary states get most of the attention, well, they're pretty exciting after all, still it comes back to actual development and evolution.
Back to actual development through the higher levels, and not just a peak experience at those higher levels.
That's right. As the self unfolds, slops and blobs on up the spiral, the self-center of gravity will tend to organize itself around a predominant higher basic level. It will tend to identify its center of gravity with this level. This will be its home base, its major fulcrum, around which it will organize most of its perceptions, its moral responses, its motivations, its drives, and so on. Thus, its center of gravity tends to shift through these higher basic spheres of consciousness with an averagely identifiable sequence.
The world wisdom traditions themselves usually give various stages, correct?
Oh yes, the traditions themselves know this. They all have their stages of growth and development. They know the characteristics of each stage. They can spot progress and they can spot regression. And as Aurobindo and Plotinus and Da Avabhasa have pointed out, although one can indeed speed up development through these stages, they cannot fundamentally be bypassed. You can peak experience ahead, jump ahead, but you'll have to make up the ground later, integrate and consolidate it later. Otherwise, you get too top-heavy, so to speak. You're floating upward and upward with no grounding and no connection to the lower structures, to the mind and body and earth and senses.
So let's get into the first of these transpersonal stages, the psychic.
As I use it, the psychic level simply means the great transition stage from ordinary, gross-oriented reality, sensory, motor, and rational and existential, into the properly transpersonal domains. Paranormal events sometimes increase in frequency at the psychic level, but that's not what defines this level. The defining characteristic, the deep structure of the psychic level, is an awareness that is no longer confined exclusively to the individual ego or centaur.
Can you give us a few examples of this?
Well, at the psychic level, a person might temporarily dissolve the separate self-sense, the ego or centaur, and find an identity with the entire gross or sensory motor world, so-called nature mysticism. You're on a nice nature walk, relaxed and expansive in your awareness, and look at a beautiful mountain, and wham! Suddenly there is no looker, just the mountain, and you are the mountain. You are not in here, looking at the mountain out there. There is just the mountain. And it seems to see itself, or you seem to be seeing it from within. The mountain is closer to you than your own skin. By any other terms, There is no separation between subject and object, between you and the entire natural world out there. Inside and outside, they don't have any meaning anymore. You can still tell perfectly well where your body stops and the environment begins. This is not psychotic a-dualism. It is your own higher self at this stage, that's fulcrum 7, which can be called the eco-noetic self. Some call it the oversoul or the world soul. This is the fusion phase of fulcrum 7. You are a nature mystic.
Somehow this seems like such an abrupt switch from an individual centauric stage of development to an identity with all of nature, as it were. I don't see the smooth evolutionary progression here.
Actually, it's not much of a leap at all. I think people get confused because we say identity moves from the individual body-mind to the whole world, which does indeed seem like a quantum leap. But that's not what happens. Look at what's actually involved. At the vision logic stage of development, where the world-centric centaur resides, one's awareness has already moved from an identity with the material dimension, that is, fulcrum 1, to an identity with a biological dimension, fulcrum 2, to an identity with a mental self, fulcrum 3. That early mental self, like the previous two fulcrums, is very egocentric and narcissistic. But with fulcrum 4, identity switches from egocentric to sociocentric. Here, your awareness already transcends its merely individual aspects. Your very awareness, your very identity, is based upon cultural roles and collective identities and shared values. It is no longer a body identity. It is a role identity. Thus, when you say, I am a father, I am a mother, I am a husband, I am a wife, I work at this job, I value this goal, those are already trans-body identities. Those already move beyond the individual body and its sensations and into a circle of intersubjective roles and values and goals. Most of the items that you call yourself are not egocentric at all, but cultural and sociocentric. When you feel yourself, you are actually feeling a circle of intersubjective events, and you exist in that cultural circle. You do not exist merely inside your skin. You have decentered, transcended, a merely body-bound identity. You can't even think who you are without existing in this cultural circle, and that circle already goes way beyond your skin boundary. With rationality and fulcrum 5, your identity decenters or expands once again, this time transcending any merely ethnocentric or sociocentric identity, and finding instead a post-conventional or world-centric identity. You actually identify yourself from a global perspective. You can no longer exist as, or identify yourself as, an ethnocentric being. It pains you to be merely ethnocentric. You are embarrassed by ethnocentric talk. You've again decentered, transcended. Your actual identity floats through and exists by virtue of a world-centric or global awareness, an identity in the circle of all human beings. It's only a small step further to actually experience your central identity, not just with all human beings, but all living beings. The global or world-centric awareness simply steps up another notch, escapes its anthropocentric prejudice, and announces itself as all sentient beings. You experience the world soul. World-centric to world soul is thus a fairly modest step, considering what has already happened in the expansion of conscious identity. It's a simple and natural continuation of the evolutionary process of transcend and include, unfold and enfold. Each emergence is a decentering, a transcendence that finds more of the external world to actually be internal or part of its very being. Molecules awoke one morning to find that atoms were inside them, enfolded in their very being, and cells awoke one morning to find that molecules were actually inside them as part of their very being. And you might awake one morning and find that nature is a part of you, literally internal to your being. You're not a part of nature, nature is a part of you. And for just that reason, you treat nature as you would treat your lungs or your kidneys. A spontaneous environmental ethics surges forth from your heart, and you will never again look at a river, a leaf, a deer, a robin in the same way. This sounds very weird and far out until you have that experience. You might ask the Apollo astronauts about it.
So it really is a very natural progression, this move from the world-centric to the world-soul.
Very much so. As I said, this looks like a radical rupture, centaur to world, because we tend to think of the individual centaur as being a single body-bound awareness. But the only stage where awareness is actually and merely body-bound is fulcrum two. Every stage past that is already quite beyond a mere bodily identity. And nothing but trouble has come from trying to define this transpersonal awareness as a single-step transformation from the skin-encapsulated ego to the nice world soul. That is not a single-step process. That is at least a seven-step process. There are at least seven fulcrums, seven massive paradigm shifts involved in getting you to a realization of this world soul.
So then how do we move from the psychic transpersonal stage to the subtle transpersonal stage of development?
Subtle simply means processes that are subtler than gross, ordinary waking consciousness. These include interior luminosities and sounds, archetypal forms and patterns, extremely subtle bliss currents and cognitions, shabd, nada, expansive, effective states of love and compassion, as well as subtler pathological states of what can only be called cosmic terror, cosmic evil, cosmic horror. As always, because of the dialectic of progress, the subtle development is most definitely not just a day at the beach. But this overall type of mysticism we call deity mysticism, because it involves your own archetypal form, a union with God or Goddess, a union with Saguna Brahman, a state of Savikalpa Samadhi, and so on. This is not just nature mysticism, not just a union with the grosser natural world, what the Buddhists call the Nirmanakaya, but a deeper union with the subtler dimensions of the Sambhogakaya, the interior bliss body or transformational body, which transcends and includes the gross or natural domain, but is not confined to it. Nature mysticism gives way to deity mysticism.
Now, are these higher levels fully present in human beings prior to their emergence?
Fully formed, no. The deep structures of these higher levels are present as potentials in all human beings, as far as we can tell. But as these deep potentials unfold, their actual surface structures are created and molded by all four quadrants. That is, the surface structures are created and molded by intentional, behavioral, cultural, and social patterns. The classic example is that a person has an experience of intense interior illumination, a subtle level illumination, perhaps in a near-death experience. A Christian might see it as Christ or an angel or a saint. A Buddhist might see it as the Sambhogakaya, or bliss body of Buddha. A Jungian might see it as an archetypal experience of the self, and so on. As we said, all depth must be interpreted, and these interpretations are not possible without a whole set of background contexts which provide many of the tools with which the interpretation will proceed. One's own individual background, one's cultural background, and one's social institutions will all have a hand in interpreting this depth experience. This is unavoidable. So these higher structures are not like fully formed little treasure chests buried in your psyche waiting to pop to the surface. The deep structures are given, but the surface structures are not, and the experience itself involves an interpretive component which cannot proceed without various backgrounds, and those backgrounds do not exist merely in your psyche. But if we reject that pre-given extreme, it doesn't mean we have to fall into the opposite error of extreme constructivism. The basic reality of this subtle experience of interior illumination is not simply or arbitrarily constructed by culture, because these experiences occur cross-culturally, and further, in many cases, the cultural background officially denies or prohibits these experiences, and yet they still happen all the time anyway. So just because these experiences have an interpretive component doesn't mean they are merely cultural creations. When you watch the sunset, you will bring interpretations to that experience as well, perhaps romantic, perhaps rational, each with a cultural coloring. But that doesn't mean that the sun ceases to exist if your culture disappears. No, these are ontologically real events. They actually exist. They have real reference. But these reference do not exist in the sensory motor world space. They don't exist in the rational world space. They don't exist in the existential world space. so you can find evidence for them in none of these world spaces. Rather, they exist in the subtle world space, and evidence for them can be plentifully found there.
You mentioned this subtle level as being an archetypal level. How is it that your use of the term archetype differs from the Jungian meaning of the word archetype?
The Jungian archetypes are basic, collectively inherited images or forms lying in the magic and mythic dimensions of human awareness. And generally speaking, these should not be confused with the developments in the psychic and subtle domains.
So how would you describe the Jungian archetype?
The typical Jungian archetype is a basic inherited image or form in the psyche. These basic or primordial images represent very common, very typical experiences that humans everywhere are exposed to. The experience of birth, of the mother, the father, the shadow, the wise old man, the trickster, the ego, the animus and anima, masculine and feminine, and so on. Millions upon millions of past encounters with these typical situations have, so to speak, ingrained these basic images into the collective psyche of the human race. You find these basic and primordial images worldwide, and you find an especially rich fund of them in the world's great myths. Since the rudimentary forms of these mythic images come embedded in the individual psyche, then when you have an encounter with, say, your own mother, you're not just encountering your particular mother. You also have this archetype or basic image of millions of years of mothering stamped into your psyche. So you're not just interacting with your mother. You're interacting with the world mother, with a great mother. And this archetypal image can therefore have an impact on you that's way out of proportion to anything your actual mother may or may not do to you. So in classical Jungian analysis, you have to analyze and interpret not just your own individual unconscious, the specific events that happen to you in your own life, with your own mother and father, your own shadow, and so on. You also need to analyze and interpret this collective level of archetypal material. Perhaps, for example, you've activated the devouring mother archetype. Maybe it has nothing to do with your actual mother. Maybe she is, for the most part, loving and attentive. And yet, you're horrified of being engulfed in relationships, devoured by emotional closeness, torn apart by personal intimacy. Maybe you're in the grip not of your actual mother, but of an archetype. And this might especially show up in dreams. Maybe a big black spider is trying to eat you. So one of the things you might want to do as you analyze this collective archetypal level is study the world's great mythologies, because they're repositories of the earlier and typical and therefore archetypal encounters, including the mothering one in general. In other words, this will give you a background against which to interpret these primordial images, and so you will be able to more sincerely and truthfully approach these images and interpret them more clearly in yourself. You will be able to differentiate from their choking grip on your awareness, and then integrate them more carefully in your life. And there is much truth to all of that, I think.
So what you're saying is that Jungian archetypes tend to be repositories of basic, collective, typical encounters of the human race in general.
For the most part. And as far as it goes, I'm in substantial agreement with those Jungian archetypes. I'm in almost complete accord with most of that Jungian perspective, and in that specific regard, I consider myself a Jungian. But the crucial point is that collective is not necessarily transpersonal. Most of the Jungian archetypes, as I said, are simply archaic images lying in the magic and mythic structures. They exert a pull on awareness from the level of fulcrums 2, 3, and 4. There's little transrational or transpersonal about them. It's important to come to terms with these archetypes, to differentiate them and integrate them, transcend and include. But they're not themselves the source of a transpersonal or genuinely spiritual awareness. In fact, for the most part, they're regressive pulls in awareness, lead weights around higher development, precisely what has to be overcome, not simply embraced. The point is, just because something is collective does not mean it is transpersonal. There are collective pre-personal structures, magic and mythic, collective personal structures, rational and existential, and collective transpersonal structures, psychic and subtle. Collective simply means that the structure is universally present, like the capacity for sensation, perception, impulse, emotion, and so on. This is not necessarily transpersonal. It is simply collective or common. We may collectively inherit 10 toes, but if I experience my toes, I am not having a transpersonal experience.
So I hear you making a distinction between genuine spirituality on the one hand and the exploration of mythological motifs or archetypes on the other. Let's take, for example, Jean Boland's book, Goddesses in Every Woman and Gods in Every Man. Now, this book is exploring mythological motifs. Wouldn't you also say that it's spiritual in nature? That it's exploring spiritual themes?
Well, it depends on what you mean by spiritual. If you mean transpersonal, no, I don't think those books are particularly transpersonal. I like those books, incidentally, but there is little in them that is actually transpersonal or genuinely spiritual. In those books, there's a wonderful presentation of all the archetypal gods and goddesses that are collectively inherited by men and women, from the steadiness and patience of Hestia to the sexuality and sensuality of Aphrodite to the strength and independence of Artemis. But those gods and goddesses are not transpersonal modes of awareness or genuinely mystical luminosities, but simply a collection of typical and everyday self-images and self-roles available to men and women. They are simply self-concepts, fulcrum 3, and self-roles, fulcrum 4, that represent common and typical potentials available to men and women pretty much everywhere. And those mythic roles are very useful in this sense. Perhaps, as a woman, you're not aware of your own capacity for strength and independence. Perhaps you need to be more in touch with the Artemis in you. By reading the various Artemis myths and stories, you can more easily access this archetypal level in your own psyche, and thus bring forth that potential in your own life. Well, this is terrific. But this is not transpersonal. This is just a mythic membership role, a persona, a type of ego relation. It is not trans-egoic. Collective typical is not transpersonal. Part of the spiritual anemia in this country is that something as prosaic as getting in touch with a strong Artemis ego in you is called transpersonal or spiritual. It's rather sad, actually.
So do you consider any of the Jungian archetypes transpersonal or transrational?
Most Jungian archetypes, the mythic archetypes, are pre-personal or at least pre-rational, magical and mythic. A few Jungian archetypes are personal, ego, persona, and a few are vaguely transpersonal, wise old man, the self, mandala. But those transpersonal archetypes are rather anemic compared to what we know about the transpersonal domains. Take, as only one example, the 18 stages of actual transpersonal growth outlined in the Mahamudra tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. These are extraordinarily detailed descriptions of the stages of evolution of higher and transpersonal awareness. And none of those stages appear in any of the world's classical myths. You will not find those stages in Zeus or Hector or Little Red Riding Hood. The reason is, those 18 stages of contemplative unfolding actually describe very rare, non-typical, non-ordinary, transpersonal growth through the psychic and subtle and causal domains. They do not describe, nor do they spring from, typical and common and everyday experiences. And so they're not found in the archaic and magic and mythic structures, and therefore they show up in none of the world's typical mythologies. Hera and Demeter and Goldilocks, and Artemis and Persephone and Hansel and Gretel never attempted these stages. And therefore you rarely find these higher stages in Robert Bly, James Hillman, Edward Edinger, Marie-Louise von Franz, Walter Odynak, or any of the great Jungian theorists.
So what you're saying is there's been a lot of confusion or conflation of the transpersonal with the collective.
Pretty much. The Jungian mythic archetypes are real enough, and they're very important, as I said. But Jung consistently failed to carefully differentiate the archetypes into their prepersonal, personal, and transpersonal components. And since all three of those are collectively inherited, then there's a constant confusing of collective and archetypal with transpersonal and spiritual and mystical. And so consciousness is simply divided into two great domains, personal and collective. And the tendency is then to take anything collective and call it spiritual, mystical, transpersonal, whereas much of it is simply pre-personal, pre-rational, pre-conventional, and even regressive. So we have some very popular theorists who, tired of the burdens of post-conventional and world-centric rational perspectivism, recommend a regressive slide into egocentric, vital-impulsive, polymorphous, phantasmic emotional revival. In other words, they recommend the fulcrum to self. They call this fulcrum to self the soul. They would like us to live from this level. But that, in my opinion, is looking for spirit in precisely those approaches that do not transcend the ego, but merely prevent its emergence in the first place.
And let's be clear, what you're saying here is that there's a distinction between spiritual as the ground of being, or the non-dual, as we'll talk about in a few moments, versus spiritual as a discrete stage of development.
Well, yes, of course.
So in your view, what are the real archetypes?
From the Neoplatonic traditions in the West to the Vedanta and Mahayana and Trikaya traditions in the East, the real archetypes are subtle seed forms upon which all of manifestation depends. In deep states of contemplative awareness, one begins to understand that the entire cosmos emerges straight out of emptiness, out of primordial purity, out of nirguna Brahman, out of the Dharmakaya, out of unqualifiable Godhead, out of radiant original face. And the first forms that emerge out of this emptiness are the basic forms upon which all lesser forms depend for their being. These forms are the actual archetypes, a term which means original pattern or primary mold. There is a light of which all lesser lights are pale shadows. There is a bliss of which all lesser joys are anemic copies. There is a consciousness of which all lesser cognitions are mere reflections. There is a primordial sound of which all lesser sounds are thin echoes. These are the real archetypes. When we find those types of statements in Plotinus or Asanga or Garab Dorje or Abhinavagupta or Shankara, they're not simply theoretical hunches or metaphysical postulates. They are direct, experiential disclosures issuing directly from the subtle dimensions of reality, interpreted according to the backgrounds of those individuals, but issuing from this profound ontological reality, the subtle world space. And if you want to know what these men and women are actually talking about, then you must take up the contemplative practice or injunction or paradigm and perform the experiment yourself. These archetypes, the true archetypes, are a meditative experience, and it's very hard to understand these archetypes without performing the experiment. They are not images existing in the mythic world space. They are not philosophical concepts existing in the rational world space. They are meditative phenomena existing in the subtle world space. So this experiment will disclose these archetypal data, and then you can help interpret what they mean. And by far the most commonly accepted interpretation is, you're looking at the basic forms and foundations of the entire manifest world. You're looking directly into the face of the divine. As Emerson said, bid the intruders take the shoes off their feet, for here is the God within.
This concludes Session 4 of A Brief History of Everything by Ken Wilber. Our program continues with Session 5.